Scott, thanks for joining me today.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Now, who was Odd McIntyre? What made him such a big celebrity during his day?
You know, Odd McIntyre was a very, very unique writer that came along in a very unique time in American history. He was a small town Ohio boy who was in the big city of New York writing about the things that he was seeing, the things that he was observing, in a way that was a lot different than what a lot of other journalists were doing at the time. And so people around the country could read what Odd wrote and put themselves easily in his situation. We in America at the time were in great transition. So people were suddenly moving from the farms and the country into the cities. And so there was a great curiosity about what was happening in the city. And there were great transitions in media. So, you know, we were going, you know, radio was being introduced, and then silent films came along. And so suddenly there was this great change in what was going on, what people read, how they spent their spare time. So Odd wrote about all that, and Americans could read it and obviously relate to it because he had 100,000 readers a day. I'm sorry, 100 million readers a day by the time he passed away.
100 million readers? Well, and I guess I have to remember, too, at the time, the newspaper was the dominant media. So
yeah, that's right. That's right. And people who previous decades, newspapers were really written more for the elite. They were written for about politics and economics and they weren't easy to read. They're very small print. And suddenly, you know, all these people had moved to the cities and they were working in factories and they had time to read because they suddenly had jobs that were paying a salary. They had the money. So a lot of people would read 3, 4, 5 newspapers a day and get magazines at the newsstands. And so the written word had a different role in society than it does for us today. But I say that in a lot of ways, though, there are some similarities between, you know, what we all experience with the, you know, the growth of social media and the way that people are communicating, and what they were experiencing back then as changes were happening.
What was his name really Odd?
His name was really Odd McIntyre. His full name was Oscar Odd McIntyre. He was named after his uncle. And his uncle supposedly was called Udd, but Odd was actually called Odd. As part of the research, I really wanted to make sure that I wasn't just reading it Odd and that people were saying Udd. And so I had to search pretty hard, but I did finally find people who were around. Odd died in 1938, so I had to find people who were around who knew his wife, who lived to be the age of 101. So she was around a lot longer. So she did refer to him as Odd when she would talk about him. So, and, you know, I mean, it was, of course, you know, you wouldn't want to saddle somebody with the name of Odd, your child. But it actually did, you know, become a part of his personal brand and made him memorable in a lot of ways. And he was, in fact, you know, in many ways, he was very odd. So the name actually ended up suiting him.
Was his byline actually Odd McIntyre, or did he use something else?
He actually used O.O. McIntyre. And O.O. McIntyre, you know, a lot of times writers back then, you know, used the initials of their name. And some of them just used, you know, all three initials. But I thought it was interesting. I got my hands on some of the actual columns that he had himself typed. And it was funny, like the breaks between lines, he actually put like a little hyphen, an O, and a little hyphen was the kind of the little symbol that he used. So he was doing interesting things with fonts, you know, long before all of us were making little smiley faces on our mobile phones.
What made you want to write about Odd?
You know, it's interesting. I was researching a book that I wrote about Richard Halliburton, who was from my same part of the country in Haywood County, Tennessee. And as part of that research, I just ran across a brief article that Odd had written about Richard Halliburton. And the style of his writing intrigued me and captivated me. And so when I'm researching, I'm always you know, pulling aside names or facts or things I want to look into when I'm done with the book. And so there were about maybe 10 things that were really interesting that I wanted to look at to consider for the next book. And the more I looked into things, the more I researched, you know, I just really was attracted to what the way that Odd wrote, and then also the fact that he was from Gallipolis, Ohio, and moved to New York. And then also there was a, you know, for a biography to be interesting, there needs to be a really good story arc. And Odd's story arc was absolutely fascinating to me, the way that he became the highest paid, most read columnist in the world was interesting. And also, I went to Gallipolis, Ohio to do some research just to see if, is there anything here to, you know, is there more information that no one knows that I can use to write a story? And there was a whole archive of information at the Rio Grande College that no one had really accessed to research or to do anything with. So there was this huge, you know, amount of fascinating information and a story. And so it all just came together. And honestly, the people of Gallipolis, Ohio were so generous and so helpful. And I almost couldn't write about Odd McIntyre after all that.
Now, what was, did Odd have any links to Cincinnati?
Yeah, you know, he wrote for the Cincinnati Post in the first decade of the 20th century, and it was around the time when your city was dealing with Boss Cox. He was, you know, I'm sure you all growing up, those of you who are from Ohio, you know, go through Ohio history classes. And, you know, we had a boss around that time in Memphis, where I'm from, and so we learned about him. Well, you know, the boss was not necessarily interested in helping the community. He was usually more interested in keeping power and having his cronies get the positions that were open in city government. So, you know, it's often debated, you know, whether they were doing good or bad. But in the end, the Cincinnati Post was looking at the things that were going on and pointing out the fact that, you know, Cincinnati was not having as much success in education as other cities of similar size. The transportation system was not working. The healthcare was, you know, the death rate among children was higher than it should have been. So the Cincinnati Post was instrumental in, like in other cities, the newspapers were instrumental in pointing out what was going on and in shining the light of truth on this darkness that was happening. They were called muckrakers. And so Odd McIntyre was working there at the Cincinnati Post when some of the leading muckrakers of the day were focusing on Cincinnati. So he was shoulder to shoulder with these men and women who were doing this great work in the city. And honestly, making a huge difference. So there's, you know, a little bit in the book about that. You know, I just found that fascinating because these young men and women were all in there. Some of them were in their teens still, and they were in their early 20s, and they were all working together. Newspapers had changed dramatically. The tone, the style, the illustrations. If it's, you know, they could use photographs now, and so working together, this group of young people really did come to make a big difference. Now, Odd was there with them, and you know, his big deficit as a journalist was that he couldn't spell very well, and he made a lot of grammatical errors. So while he was there, he just gained a huge appreciation for the work that journalists do, and also, you know, considered himself years later a newspaper man, but never really felt like he had the same skill set as a journalist that these, you know, men and women did that he saw during that era.
Do you think he was surprised by his success?
You know, that's a good question. I think he was in many ways, in some ways, I think he was isolated from his success. I don't know from his reading, you know, I read his unpublished autobiography that he wrote. I've read some things by his wife and some things by his friends that they were, you know, wrote candidly about him. I don't know that his success ever actually sunk in. He continued to try. I think it was very telling that when he negotiated one of his last, his wife actually negotiated all his contracts. When his wife had negotiated one of his, you know, one of his biggest contracts, I found a letter from the syndicate, from the president of the syndicate, that had been mailed to Odd's father back in Missouri. And it had said, Odd asked me to send you the details of his current contract. And it said how much he was making. And, you know, so Odd was still, you know, as a huge success, he was still trying to get his father's approval and validation. So, you know, he also was suffering from a disease called pernicious anemia. And as I was trying to figure out, you know, I noticed there were a lot of strange behavioral traits that people referred to that I saw in letters that, you know, that I saw in, but nobody attributed it to anything. So I really did a lot of research on what could this be. I really do think it was pernicious anemia. You're not supposed to, historians are not supposed to diagnose people from the past, but the traits of pernicious anemia are hallucinations, insecurity, severe depression, drastic weight loss, and weight gains.
And Scott,
he had all those symptoms.
And that's like a vitamin B deficiency, Scott. Is that what that is?
Yeah, correct.
Okay.
That's absolutely right. And it no one has it now, because if you even begin to have it a little bit, they can quickly write you a prescription. Towards the very, very end of his life, a group of doctors discovered that if someone would eat, if someone who had pernicious anemia would eat 3 pounds of liver a day, then they could begin to get better. You know, so I don't know what would be worse, having pernicious anemia or having to eat 3 pounds of liver a day.
But, yeah, exactly.
You know, no one has this, so we don't even know that it existed for the most part. So I do think that, you know, and that it impacted him in a variety of ways. Not only did he die at a really young age of 54, but he also, towards the end, could barely walk, couldn't move his neck, could barely function. He suffered bouts of depression so severe that he would just lay in his bed in the fetal position and sob, you know, for weeks at a time. And of course, back then, there was not medication to be able to treat things like that. And so he really did, he had to suffer through a lot to be able to do what he loved. And I don't know that if you asked him if he would ever say that he was successful.
Do you think the public ever picked up on the fact that he was so ill? Did he ever tell his readers that he was that ill?
They knew that he had a lot of peculiarities, because he himself would talk about how he was afraid that for years he was afraid of open spaces, so he wouldn't walk across Central Park. That he said it in sort of a joking way, and you know, he talked about the fact that he had large amounts of clothing that he never really wore, but he didn't really attribute it to anything. And so all of these oddities, if you will, about him were sort of talked about tongue in cheek and with a sparkle in the eye, that really masked the true impact of what he was actually dealing with. And you know, his wife, Maybelle, you know, I mean, God bless her. She's the one who, you know, she went to New York with her new husband, and shortly after he arrived there to work for Hamptons Magazine, he lost his job. And then suddenly he's unemployed, and he's dealing with such depression that he cannot physically function. And so she's the one who said, hey, you know how you write a letter to our friends back in Gallipolis that they really love? Let's write a letter to New York about New York, and I'll send it to newspapers all over the country and tell them they can print it if they want. And so that motivated him to get out of bed enough to where he could actually start doing a letter. And the to gather content, he started to get out of the house and go around, and that's when he became made a lot of contacts on Tin Pan Alley and started representing, you know, a lot of the music publishers and the entertainers, and he tried to get them in the newspaper because he knew how newspapers worked. He was, and because he loved theater and he loved music, he was really good at getting coverage for entertainment. So then he became the publicist for Ziegfeld for many years and became really close friends with Will Rogers. He began working with a lot of the Hollywood stars and was close friends with all like Charlie Chaplin and, you know, all the silent film stars. Valentino and he were very good friends. And so all along, he would include these people in the columns that he wrote that his wife was sending out all over the nation. And before they knew it, their column was picked up just from the two of them doing it from this, you know, this little dingy apartment in New York. Suddenly, you know, they were growing all over the nation. Newspapers were running his column, and it was becoming successful. So he, in a lot of ways, he really was, you know, sort of the first blogger.
What was the biggest challenge you faced, Scott, in writing about Odd McIntyre?
Odd never considered himself to be a factual journalist. He wrote to entertain. And so if he said he had lunch with Charlie Chaplin, I didn't include it in the book as a fact unless I could prove it by looking through the Charlie Chaplin archives or by finding facts that would support everything he said. If something is just something he said without being supported, I noted that in the book so that it's actually a factual account of his life. So it was hard to determine with every single thing whether he just wrote that or whether it really happened. And that was a criticism that towards the end of his life he really had to deal with frequently, with people who criticized him, because, you know, part of his, you know, column that he would include a couple of times a week would be something called Thoughts While Strolling. And he spelled it THOTS sometimes, but Thoughts While Strolling. And he would just sort of string together a seemingly unconnected stream of consciousness style, several paragraphs. And it would be as though he were walking along in New York and what he would see and smell and experience. And it almost reads like poetry. You know, I mean, it truly to me is like, gymnastics almost, the way he strung all these together. But people would criticize, people who lived in New York knew that if somebody was walking along stream of consciousness style, they wouldn't be able to get as quickly from one point to the other as what he was writing. So, you know, so it wasn't necessarily factual, but it was very entertaining. So that was the biggest challenge, is trying to make sure that I created a biography that was actually a true reflection of his life.
Now, how much did your work at the museum influence the book?
The museum here is a museum of the First Amendment and free expression. And, you know, freedom of the press is a big part of what we focus on. And so, you know, the journalism greats of the past and the rules they lived by and the importance of newspaper reporting, you know, is now, you know, something that I'm well aware of and is very much in my brain. So as I was doing the research, I would run across the names that I oftentimes see here at the museum, or the names of the, you know, the journalism greats that came before us. And so, you know, that definitely, when I'm explaining something that happened, I'm definitely explaining it through the prism of what I've experienced here at the museum and in my previous job at Elvis Presley Enterprises, you know, where, you know, I was exposed to, you know, elements of fame and what celebrity does to people. And so, you know, both of those jobs sort of colored, you know, what I wrote about Odd. And I think possibly that's why I was attracted to him as a character to write about, because he was definitely the first, in my opinion, the first pop culture reporter, because he was reporting not just about facts. He was reporting about sports and fashion and food, and he was reporting about entertainment of all kinds, you know, vaudeville, Broadway. He was reporting about all these different things, and that really wasn't done as much by many people back then. And he was absolutely, there may have been others doing something somewhat similar, but he was absolutely the one who did it the best.
Scott, thanks so much for joining me today.
Absolutely. Thank you. I hope if anybody wants more information on the book, they can go to anoddbook.com. And there's a lot there about Odd and Cincinnati and what Odd did and what he accomplished. So more than anything, I just want to introduce